Yeah, hi people. This particular podcast, podcast 45, has been a bit of a nightmare. First off, I tried to record it on my Belkin Go Studio using my iPod as the hard drive, you know, bit of an experiment, see how it goes. And the iPod crashed 5 minutes from the end of the podcast. It lost everything. The second time, I tried to do it on a laptop, and Windows totally screwed the pooch, lost everything I'd done. I ended up getting sick of it and totally reinstalling the hard drive from scratch, which I spent last night doing. So, this podcast is take three of Paleo Cinema Podcast 45. My name's Terry Frost, and welcome to my nightmare.
Paleo Cinema is a three-weekly podcast that looks at film noir, horror, cult movies, classic films, science fiction, and other genre works from 1895 to 1980. The email address is cultguru@gmail.com, cultguru@gmail.com. So please send comments, feedback, and MP3 voicemails to that address. The blog for the podcast, which has lots of extra content relating to each episode, and is paleo-cinema.blogspot.com. This podcast contains adult content and occasional swearing, so don't lend your MP3 player to children.
Okay, so what's been going on? I should update you on what's been happening. On the bad side, I'm currently unemployed. My agency called me up Wednesday night and said don't come in on Thursday. So things were a bit tight at the moment. We're a little bit concerned about money, but I've got the irons in the fire. Little bit shaky emotionally, but I'm doing okay. So if the podcast does sound a bit rocky, apart from the fact that it is being recorded for the third attempt, there's an emotional reason why, and I'll try to minimise that. I don't want to lay my shit on you people. But that's it. Now, movies. I've been watching some movies. I'll give you an example of four of them I watched. First off, I watched the worst movie of the 21st century so far. You might know what it is. It's Tommy Wiseau's The Room, a kind of kitchen sink domestic drama come train wreck of a fucking film. I'll tell you, it's woeful. The big problem with it really is, well, Tommy Wiseau. Look, you're not going to make yourself, you shouldn't make yourself protagonist in a film if you've got a few qualities. One of which is if you sound like Arnold Schwarzenegger's whiny gay little brother. Not a good way to gain rapport from the audience. The second thing is you should not look like a corpse that's been in a river for 2 days. And unfortunately, for whatever reason, Tommy Wiseau does. He's got lank hair. He looks like Mary Shelley's description. If you go back to the original novel of Frankenstein, he looks a lot like Mary Shelley's description of the Frankenstein monster. He's got pale, sallow skin, lank hair, and basically he looks like the original Frankenstein's monster. One of the other things I hate about the guy, sex scenes with nudity are something human beings are wired to enjoy. We're wired to enjoy sex, we're wired to look at it, particularly guys. So guys are visually oriented. It takes a particular skill to make a sex scene totally uninteresting. But Tommy Wiseau, having whatever the opposite of talent is, manages it somehow. And it is an atrocious piece of film. There are plot lines that never develop into anything. There are characters that appear and disappear at random. Not even deliberately bad, it's accidentally bad. And in a totally uninteresting way. You should see this film just once, and do see it with somebody else sitting beside you. I'll tell you why. You need to have somebody to whom you can turn and say, what the fuck? You need a what the fuck buddy. That's the only reason to see this film once. I would also recommend that you anaesthetize yourself with some amount of alcohol. I didn't do it. I didn't have anybody with me when I watched it. And I wasn't self-medicating on ethanol. but I should have been. So I saw that. At least I can say that I've seen it, and I can move on from that. Now, one of the other things I saw was a movie called The H-Man, which I recommend that the guys over at B-Movie Podcast have a go at. It's a Japanese monster film, essentially. A bunch of guys on a boat are irradiated after a nuclear test and turn into basically snot that eats people. Interesting film from that premise. I mean, I wouldn't really sell it on the premise if I was pitching it to a studio. But it does have these crazy nightclub scenes all the way through it with really weird Japanese jazz combos and chicks in exotic Matahari bikinis dancing around the place. I mean, you could just link together all of the nightclub scenes in this film and ditch the rest of it, because the rest of it's kind of a little like The Human Vapor. It's got that police procedural, somebody's doing something and the police need to investigate how, and they spend a lot of time in offices talking about it and showing each other pieces of paper and stuff. But, yeah, it's kind of interesting. The snot monsters were done quite well, given the obviously the budgetary and technological limitations of the time. But I had heard about it, so I decided to watch it, and I wasn't disappointed by it. The next film I got is historical for a very unusual reason. 1970 was a landmark year in cinema, not for any reason that you can think of. The reason it's a landmark year in cinema is two movies came out, Quiet Days in Clichy and the movie I saw, Tropic of Cancer. I'd seen Quiet Days of Clichy back in the 70s in the cinema, and I think I've seen it more recently as well. But the reason these two films have a place in cinema history are as follows. They are the first mainstream films to ever say cunt. Now, they're both based on Henry Miller's story, so saying cunt was pretty much implicit in the premise. And to be honest with you, like a really lovely botanical garden, there are a lot of abundant bushes in this film. There's a lot of nudity, female nudity. Ellen Burstyn, 4 years before she did The Exorcist, has a full frontal nude scene in this film. And any number of other attractive women. So there's a lot of eye candy in that sense in the film. But the best bits of it, Rip Torn plays Henry Miller in the film. The best bits of it aren't Rip Torn, who kind of plays Henry Miller as if he's some kind of mafia goomba wandering through the streets of Paris and bashing a typewriter. The best bits are Rip Torn reading Henry Miller's prose while the film shows you beautiful scenery of the streetscapes of Paris in 1970, the avenues, the alleyways, the River Seine, the Arc de Triomphe, all that kind of stuff, the little shops and things. I love Paris as a city, and it kind of works when he's just there reading Henry Miller's stuff, and the camera cruises past the boulevards of Paris. So I saw that. Did see an exceptionally good film, and it's a more recent film, The Hurt Locker. Catherine Bigelow's The Hurt Locker. Just this very day, one raked up the BAFTAs really big time, where Avatar didn't. And it's a movie about a small squad of bomb disposal experts working in either Iraq or Afghanistan, getting rid of improvised explosive devices. And human bombs and all sorts of other bits and pieces. It's a very episodic movie because, of course, the nature of the work these guys do is episodic. But fantastic piece of film. Jeremy Renner is the breakout star of that one. Fantastic piece of acting. Subtle at times. The script's great. The direction really works. It doesn't have too much shaky cam in it, which is a nice change from a lot of recent films. It has a lot of tension and drama in it. It has that feel of reality that so many Hollywood films don't have. And one of the nice things I like about it is that even though there is a political subtext, it's not judgmental. It doesn't take sides. It just shows these guys doing this job in this place and the unusual, extraordinary stresses that puts them under, and the way it turns them into, in a sense, war junkies. They become addicted to war. I did enjoy the film a lot. It's an incredible piece of filmmaking. And I've got no hesitation in saying that Catherine Bigelow is a much better filmmaker than James Cameron. My favourite James Cameron movie is still Piranha 2. Definitely see that one. It's going to rake up all the awards, and it's definitely one that's worth buying on DVD when it comes out, if it hasn't already in your part of the world. Now, I'm going to take a break, play some very mellow music for you, and then we'll get stuck into the actual films.
The boat rides we would take, the moonlight on the lake, the way we danced and hummed our favorite song, the things we did last summer, I'll remember all winter long. The midway and the fun, the Cupid dolls we won, the bell I rang to prove that I was strong, the things we did last summer, I'll remember all winter long. The early morning hike, the rented tandem bike, the lunches that we used to pack. We never could explain that sudden summer rain, the looks we got when we got back. The leaves began to fade, like promises we made. How could a love that seemed so right go wrong? The things we did last summer, I'll remember all winter long. I'll remember all winter long.
Okay, that incredibly mellow and wonderful piece of music was The Things We Did Last Summer by one of the unsung jazz singers of the world, Jackie Paris. There's actually a documentary called Tis Autumn, The Search for Jackie Paris, which I want to get a copy of, but I haven't been able to locate yet. Anyway, on to the movies. Anybody remember a movie from roughly 26 years ago called Splash? Daryl Hannah playing a mermaid, Tom Hanks, John Candy playing the comic relief kind of character. Basically, that movie was pinched from another two films. These films being Miranda from 1948, a British comedy done by Gainsborough Pictures, and its sequel from 6 years later, 1954, Mad About Men. Copied it very badly, and I'll explain why it's badly, and then I'll dismiss Splash and talk about Miranda and Mad About Men. The reason why Splash doesn't work for me, yes, I know it was very popular and everyone loved Ron Howard as a director because he used to be Andy Griffith's kid. The reason it doesn't work is this. The charismatic characters in that film were the guys, John Candy, Tom Hanks. Daryl Hannah was the carrot on the stick for Tom Hanks' character. She was basically the reward he gets for being a good guy. It doesn't work like that. Miranda takes an entirely different viewpoint on this. I'll just play you a little bit from the start of the film just to give you an idea. This is basically the story is this. A London doctor played by Griffith Jones goes to Cornwall for a fishing holiday. He leaves his wife behind. She doesn't want to go fishing. She's gone fishing with him for 5 years. She doesn't want to go anymore. And he gets pulled overboard while fishing by a mermaid, Miranda, played by Glynis Johns. She takes him to a cave and decides she's going to keep him there. They have a bit of a chat. She's fascinated by human men. Mermen have little eyes and no chins, and she's kind of, well, realistically, she's kinky for human men. They have legs, they have hair, they don't have beady little eyes all the time. And so she makes a deal with him that if he takes her to London for 2 weeks, disguised as an invalid, she'll let him go. So they cut a deal. He decides he's going to get a nurse to help her around the place in a wheelchair. And Miranda goes to London and finds out there's not just one attractive man there. There's any number of them. And she basically falls enamored of three different men. The doctor's chauffeur, played by David Tomlinson. The doctor himself, of course. And a friend of the doctor's, an artist played by John McCallum, the Australian actor who died about a week ago. Very long career as an actor and also as a producer. He produced Skippy the Bush Kangaroo, amongst other things. So, you know, kind of iconic status in the Australian film industry. And unfortunately, recently died. His wife, Googie Withers, who plays the doctor's wife in this film, is still alive and still living in Australia. So when I heard that John McCallum had died, I thought I'd make a little note of this. He is quite good as one of the three pretty basically clueless guys in the film. The reason the Miranda and Mad About Men works better is their guys aren't in control. They are in no way in control. They're fascinated and mesmerized by Miranda's forthrightness. She's open about the fact that she finds men attractive and she really is interested in them in an overtly sexual way. She likes legs, for instance. She loves legs. She loves ears. And in every sense of the way, she's kind of kinky for another species. Though, as her ancestry proves, there is cross-species breeding possible. One of her great ancestors was a human. Yeah, so that's basically it. I'll just play a little bit from the start of Miranda just to give you a bit of an idea about how Miranda and the Doctor interact in this film. It's a fascinating, charming little movie.
I suppose you think you're seeing things.
Yes, nurse.
Nurse?
You are a nurse, aren't you?
Do I look like a nurse?
No. Oh. I must have hit my head as I went down.
I wish you wouldn't stare.
You're certainly not a nurse. Who are you?
Miranda.
Miranda. Where am I?
You're in my cave. I brought you here. You fell out of your boat.
Fell? I was pulled.
You're a rotten swimmer.
Be a bit light-headed, but to me you seem to have a
tail?
Yeah.
I have. I'm a mermaid.
...1948, a good year for movies. There was another mermaid film made in the same year called Mr. Peabody and the Mermaid. It was a Hollywood film starring William Powell and let me see who played the mermaid. I'm just trying to get my details together on this one. Anne Blythe playing Lenore the Mermaid, so I'm not sure whether one film copied the other or whether there's any crossover at all, or maybe it was just purely a coincidence, but it pretty much followed the same plotline. I haven't seen that, but I will try to track down a copy of it at some stage just to glom it out. It's one of those things where two films come out with the same theme, essentially, you know, at more or less the same time. Basically, it's a comedy of manners, in a sense, and you've got somebody, a stranger coming in who transgresses all the ideas society has about decorum and class and what's correct behaviour, merely because she doesn't know them and has an incredible fascination for human men, which does make her very kinky. I mean, she's basically kinky for another species, in a sense, the way one of her ancestors was. But one of the things that I kind of like about this film is it shows that post-war opening up of sexuality in society. The war really smashed that to pieces. The war totally shattered everybody in England's idea of what was right behaviour or not. They were about to be invaded. They were being bombed on a daily basis. Life could end at any time. Why the hell not enjoy it? There were people fucking in air raid shelters in tube stations. And if you read the biography of Eric Sykes, if I don't write it, who will? And Hermione Gingold's autobiography, How to Grow Old Disgracefully. Both of them talk at some stage about the opening up of sexuality during the war for the soldiers in Eric Sykes' case and for Marnie Jingold as an actress. The whole society just exploded sexually in a lot of ways, and of course there are a lot of unwanted pregnancies and things like that and a lot of complications there. But in general, people kind of reevaluated what they thought was important and what they should and shouldn't do with their lives. That is reflected in a lot of these films, from particularly up until probably the late, up until things like Espresso Bongo in 1959. You've got that weird and wonderful society says one thing at some level, but the reality that people live with is something quite different from that. I mean, if you have a look at that, say, 15-year period of film from 1945 to 1960, you see some interesting changes in the way society is reflected. All the way from they kind of go from George Formby comedies to a kind of loving in a 15-year period, which makes it a really kind of rich time to look at in particularly light comedy films and also in serious dramas as well. So Miranda's not a particularly long film. It runs 80 minutes and it was released in April in 1948. So there you go with that. But the second film, which unlike Miranda is in beautiful, glorious colour, Mad About Men, was released 6 years later. It stars Glynis Johns, again playing a dual role, Caroline Truella, who is a distant cousin of Miranda's, and Miranda herself. Basically, the plot of this one is Miranda, who is a mermaid, swaps places with her human cousin Caroline while Caroline goes on holiday. Caroline, who's a school teacher, is identical to Miranda in appearance from the waist up, so it's easy for Miranda to impersonate her. Caroline is engaged to be married, but Miranda doesn't like Caroline's fiancé. That's basically the plot of the film. The ensemble, again, the only two surviving characters from the previous film are Glynis Johns and Margaret Rutherford, playing the mermaid and the nurse. There's a few additions there that are quite fun. Donald Sinden playing the love interest, Jeff Saunders, is quite fun. Dora Bryan playing Berengaria, who is another mermaid who is a friend to Miranda and her accompanist when Miranda sings. So it's a somewhat a lesser film than Miranda. It doesn't have the same shock value, but it still has that kind of forthright sexuality that that Miranda talks about. And of course, you got to think about this, think this through a little bit. I'm sure people did at the time. How does a mermaid make love with a human being? How does that happen? And that there's a line in the first film where she says that she has abilities to surprise men. So there's something there that happens, which isn't not entirely unappealing. So there's a speculation you can make there, which it's has absolutely nothing at all to do with the comments I made earlier about watching Tropic of Cancer. In Splash, of course, they cheat on that by giving the mermaid legs occasionally. So they kind of fudge that one without going the total kink the way they do in these films. There's no fudging of, oh, yes, he can make love to the mermaid because she grows legs. None of that kind of business. That's about all I want to say about those films. I think they should be seen. Mad About Men runs about 10 minutes longer than Miranda does. It was directed by Ralph Thomas, who did a lot of Carry On movies and did all those Doctor at Sea, Doctor at Large kind of things with Dirk Bogarde in the 1950s. So he's a dab hand at I just like them. I like the kind of sweetness about them. I like the fact that in a sweet, subtle, very English way, very kind of proper English way, there are subversive films. There's a subtext of sexuality there that slightly titillating without being too overt. So, in that way, I do like them. I'm just going to take another break now. I'll talk about the last film, which again delves into the realm of sexuality somewhat. It's Max Ophuls' 1950 film, La Ronde.
Pour que l'amour commence à ronde, que manque-t-il? Une valse. Voici la valse. La valse tourne, le carrousel tourne, et la ronde de l'amour peut tourner aussi. Tourne, tourne, mes personnages,
âge, la terre retourne jour et nuit. L'eau de pluie se change en nuages et les nuages retombent en pluie. Femme honnête, grisette tendre, aristocrate ou bien soldat, quand l'amour vient les surprendre, tourne, danse d'un même pas. Maintenant la ronde commence, c'est l'heure calme où meurt le jour. Regardez, la fille s'avance, voici la ronde de l'amour. La ronde de l'amour.
Okay, we move on to the next film, La Ronde. Laurent's a 1950 film directed by Max Ophuls, who was another one of the German Jewish directors who fled Nazi oppression and went to Hollywood. He made five films in Hollywood and then came back to Europe, whereupon he made Laurent. The movie is based on a play which was written in 1900 by a guy called Arthur Schnitzler. I'll just read the bit from Wikipedia about the play just to give you a better idea. It scrutinizes the sexual morals and class ideology of its day through a series of encounters between pairs of characters, shown before or after a sexual encounter. By choosing characters across all levels of society, the play offers social commentary on how sexual contact transgresses boundaries of class. At first, Schnitzler circulated the play privately among friends. It was not publicly performed until 1920, some two decades later, when it elicited violent critical and popular reaction against its subject matter. Schnitzler was attacked as a Jewish pornographer, and the outcry came to be known as the Reigen scandal because the German title for the play was Reigen. The title, both in German and French, reversed to a round dance as portrayed in English nursery rhymes like Ring a Ring of Roses. So basically that's the play that the movie's based on. The movie structure is fascinating right from the start. The pivotal character, and very much pivotal character in this film, is a guy called Raconteur, played by Anton Warburg, who you might remember from The Life and Death of Colonel Blimp. He played Theo Kretschmar-Schuldorf and had that fantastic speech about Nazism at the end of the film. Very charismatic actor. He plays Raconteur, who is kind of the fuse that lights the story, in a sense. At the start of the film, he walks up through a number of the stage sets where the movie takes place, talking about, who am I? Am I a compere? Am I you? Who am I? What he is he's a kind of demigod, or a Greek chorus as well as a demigod, who sets things in motion. He finally walks up to a small carousel and sings a song, which I'll play for you in a few moments. Eventually on the carousel, the first character, a prostitute called Leocadie, played by Simone Signoret, appears. He tells her to pick up the sixth soldier that walks past her when she goes to stand on her street corner. And she does so, starting the play and the rondelay kind of thing going. There are basically a whole bunch of different encounters between a bunch of different characters in this film. There's the sexual encounter between the whore and the soldier, the soldier and a parlour maid, the parlour maid and a young gentleman, the young gentleman and a young wife, the young wife and her husband, the husband and a young lady and a poet, the poet and an actress, the actress and a count, and to bring it full circle, the count and the whore. So it's basically a circular ring of relationships. One of the subtexts of this is, of the original play in particular, is that it's a metaphor for the transmission of a venereal disease, particularly syphilis, throughout all social classes. So there's a little bit of a social subtext, as well as the transgression of social boundaries. There's a disease being spread through different social levels. And that's basically what the play's about. But the film itself is magical. It's the fact that Raconteur starts it off and appears as various minor characters throughout the story of the different couples meeting and things like that. He's a maitre d' at a restaurant. He plays a soldier himself. He There's a man sitting smoking a pipe and instructing somebody at one stage, and he's also a film editor of all things. So basically, wherever the structure of the film falls apart, he pushes the narrative ahead. He's influential. He's pulling the strings in a sense, but only very, very lightly. And he interacts with various characters in the film. Some in a terse way when he doesn't think that what they're doing is right. Other times in an encouraging way. When the housemaid, played by Simone Simon, who you'll remember from Cat People, has an unhappy liaison with the soldier, played by a guy called Serge Reggiani. Raconteur takes her 2 months into her future where her life's in a better place, and she can then move on to her second encounter with the young gentleman played by Daniel Guélin. So he's pushing along, but he's also encouraging in a sense. He's the motor that's spinning the carousel. And Warbrook does this beautifully. He's stylish and witty, and if a god existed, you'd want it to be someone like Anton Warbrook. I'll just play the little song. It was the last movie score done by a composer called Oscar Strauss, and it's probably his best known and most memorable one. So I'll play that, and I'll come back and talk a little more about Laurent and how marvelous it is.
Pour que l'amour commence à ronde, que manque-t-il? Une valse. Voici la valse. La valse tourne, le carrousel tourne, et la ronde de l'amour peut tourner aussi. Tourne, tourne, mes personnages, la terre tourne jour et nuit. L'eau de pluie se change en nuages, et les nuages retombent. Femme honnête, grisette tendre, aristocrate ou bien soldat, quand l'amour vient les surprendre, tourne, danse d'un même pas. Maintenant la ronde commence, c'est l'heure calme où meurt le jour. Regardez, la fille s'avance, voici la ronde de l'amour. La ronde de l'amour.
Laurent's actually been adapted cinematically about a dozen, 13 times. Since 1950, there was the Max Ophuls version, there was a Roger Vadim version in 1964 with Jane Fonda in it. There's a movie called Hot Circuit in 1971. There's a German version called Reigen in 1973. There's another version in 1982, 1983. Alan Rudolph's film Choose Me is based on Laurent. There's a version in 1985, 1998, 2002, 2004, 2005. There's another one in development. So the story does have legs. It's definitely one that people do find interesting to follow. Now, this film in particular, the acting and the way that Ophuls frames things and is extraordinary. It just blew me away. Why haven't I heard about this film before? It's kind of in that league of film. The young wife in the movie is played by one of my favorite French actors, Daniel Darrieux, who was also the mother in The Young Girls of Rochelle, which I talked about in a podcast a while back. She's absolutely stunning in this film. If you want a bit of trivia, Daniel Darrieux is the only person who is name-checked in Inglourious Basterds who's still alive. Not, you know, influenced by the movie, but name-checked in the movie. She's the only human being still alive who was name-checked in Inglourious Basterds, and she's a fantastic actress. She's been in films since the 1930s. Did a little background on Daniel Darrieux and found out that she had a bit of problem during World War II, as indeed did several other people. But in her case, she continued to work on the stage, and she worked on some projects which were considered to be unpatriotic by the French during the German occupation. But it was only afterwards, when the Germans had been defeated, that it was found out that the reason she did these things was in order to keep her brother out of a concentration camp. He was about to be incarcerated by the Nazis, and she cut a deal that she would continue to work on the stage and continue to do plays and things like that and keep the theatre going to try to placate the masses in order to keep her brother out of a concentration camp. And after that was discovered, her history during the war was better understood by the people who were criticising her. And she went on to be, as she is now, basically a national treasure in France. She's a very old lady now and living in Paris. But in this film, she has a beautiful arc as the young wife who is surreptitiously visiting the young man and tells him at the start she can only stay for 5 minutes. And there's a slow, gradual progression through that part of the story, which is not necessarily in the dialogue, but it's partly in the way she moves, the looks she has. You can see the thoughts reflected in her face. It's a marvelous piece of acting, mind-blowingly good, not showy and broad, but subtle and incredibly interesting. A lot of the other people in this film are good. Odette Joyeux as Anna, the young girl, is very good. Issa Miranda, an Italian actress, as the actress, Charlotte, is fantastic. And just the little vignettes of each character interacting with the next character in line makes this film incredibly charming. I do have a couple of Max Ophüls films I haven't yet watched, but I am definitely going to. This film is magic. I'm really going to have to stop looking at shallow films for a while and do a little more in this kind of film, which is very accessible. I mean, I can't see anybody who enjoys movies not enjoying it, even if they're just a normal kind of movie buff. But the layering and the depths of this film and the way character is revealed by the way the film's shot and the subtlety of acting really does have me in awe. I remember, I may have mentioned this in the podcast before, I was once at a press conference of Kevin Spacey's when he said that cinema as a young medium, we're still learning how to do it, and that the best years of cinema are in the future, because as we learn more about how the medium and we develop a tradition of cinema, unlike a lot of other art forms which have thousands of years of history behind them. In this case, it kind of goes contrary to what Kevin Spacey was saying. This is a perfect film, done not on a large budget, but with a lot of imagination, a perfect cast, a fantastic director, a script and a plot structure that all come together in a kind of perfect storm. I don't know what else I can say about this film. Please see it. There is a Criterion edition out. I don't know whether you'll be able to find it or not, but I do definitely recommend it. It's a bit wonderful. I will put up a YouTube video on paleo-cinema.blogspot.com of just the first few minutes of Laurent, where you can see raconteur walking through the stage sets and meeting the first character in the Laurent. And just get a bit of an idea of how it works. So that's about it for that. I'm going to take another break, and then when I'm finished, I'm going to come back and do the correspondence. Yes, we did get correspondence this time around.
How did you get into my horoscope? You funny, irascible, lovable dope. Isn't it clear from the stars that you haven't a hope with me? Anyone else would have known in advance. Libra and Gemini haven't a chance. Anyone else would have seen at a glance. It could never be. Chalk and cheese. We're as different as chalk and cheese. Were there ever two people more out of step before? More unalike if you please. Souls apart, we are opposite poles apart. When I think about me and you, say, how'd you do? Maybe it wasn't so smart. Me, I'm bright, got a groovy scene. I like to be where it's at. You're uptight as a tambourine. What kind of music is that? Chalk and cheese, who would ever blend things like these? On the other hand, people say love is here to stay. Hooray for the birds and the bees. For you speak to me and my legs go weak at the knees. I'm a fool, maybe, but I don't mind chalk with my cheese. With my cheese.
Yeah, the first email I got was from Vince over at the B-Movie Cast. He said, "Hi, Terry, I was just listening to the cast. Sorry about the email. There was supposed to be an MP3 attachment with the email, but I guess it did not get sent. Sorry. Cheers, Vince." Yeah, Vince had a very brief email to me. I just thought he was being funny, but apparently there was a voicemail attached to it. So, sorry I didn't pick up on that, Vince, but nice hearing for you. And keep up the good work with B-Movie Cast as well. Okay, Troy also sent us an email about the podcast. Troy says, "Hey Terry, thanks for reviewing my pick on the Paleo Cinema 44 podcast. You did a superb job as usual. Of course, The Night of the Hunter is also one of my favourite movies, and I really enjoyed your review of that film as well. I used to visit Scarecrow Video quite a bit in the 90s when my friend used to live nearby. It used to be the only place I could find extremely rare psychotronic movies back then. I'm glad that they're still around and relevant. Thanks to you and Scarecrow, I'm now going to embark on a quest to see all the movies referenced in Inglourious Basterds." So, good luck with that one, Troy. There are any number of them. I mean, you'd have to go and see every movie by Daniel Derrière and all those other actors who are name-checked in it, I suppose. But anything like that, I found the same with Scorsese documentaries on Italian cinema and the 100 years of American cinema as well. It's great having a resource there from someone knowledgeable that you can draw on to discover new films. Of course, Tarantino and Scorsese being the two best in the world for that sort of thing, under my opinion. Troy goes on to say, "The Winter Olympics are happening only 255 kilometres from me, so even though I'm not much of a sports fan by any stretch of the imagination, I seem to be catching Olympic fever. Probably because I love Vancouver so much. Look forward to your next podcast. Stay cool in the heat, Troy." Thanks for that, Troy. I did try to watch a little of the Olympics today, to be really honest with you. I got about 2 minutes into people going downhill in what looked like a billy cart in a tube full of ice. But didn't grab me. It just happened, you know, one thing happened and then the next people did the same thing. And the people after that did the same thing. It's just not my sort of thing. It's a bit like, you know, Groundhog Day for thrill seekers. So thanks for that. I appreciate the feedback. I'm going to do more listener request podcasts. I've still got a few things that people have requested that I'll do in future ones, but I may just kind of slide them in amongst the other things that I do. So I do appreciate that feedback. Let's see what I've got there. I got one from Fossil John. "Hi Terry, please will you cover Walkabout and I understand the need for the right headspace. Both Night of the Hunter and Sullivan's Travels were on my shortlist for you to cover, so I'm pleased you got these from other listeners. Hunter is probably in my top five and is one of those movies that had a huge impact on me as a child, although I didn't know what it was until nearly 30 years later. I'm always enormously affected by the moment when the boy reacts to the capture and restraint of Harry Powell, played by Robert Mitchum, mirroring the reaction he had to his father's capture at the beginning. Stay well, looking forward to Walkabout, Fossil John." Thanks for that. Fossil Joint. I will get to Walkabout. Again, it's one of those things I want to give good attention to, so I want to be kind of in a slightly more sanguine headspace than I am right now. But it's definitely going to be there. I got an email from Ben over at Cinecultania Podcast. Definitely listen to that one. Those guys are kicking ass and taking names. Ben says, hi, howdy Terry. As you know, I'm a recent convert to your show, but it has quickly become one of my favourites. As I wandered to the train and on my way to work today, I felt so very stressed until your mellow voice and the groovy Italian-inspired tunes of the Frankenheimer episode mellowed me out. Congratulations on having such a spiffy show, very intelligent and intriguing, with great side streets of information, and I love it when the exploitation junkie within surfaces every now and then for a great aside. Now, WR Mysteries of the Organism was brought up recently as a recommendation for a possible psychologist-themed episode, but after brief contemplation, my mind turned towards Haxan, which crossed through the ages, not the slightly painful William Burroughs jazzed-up version of the 1960s, but the original cut version from 1922. Why? Well, it is true that both deal with human psychology and pathology to a degree, but they're also semi-fictionalized documentaries mixing narrative recreations, flights of fancy, and documentary realism. I have a severe soft spot for Haxan. It's like watching cinema from another planet, and in many regards could certainly stand as ground against more modern, supposedly more extreme, the more modern and supposedly more extreme visions of Makachev. He's talking about Makachev, who directed WR Mysteries of the Organism. Perhaps an interesting episode theme would be to examine how the mixing of fiction and documentary has altered through cinema history. Look forward to revisiting your older episodes and many more new ones. And perhaps a beer or two at some time. Until next time, Ben. Thanks for that, Ben. Haxan is available on, I think it's in archive.org, sorry. So I know it's out there and available, so definitely going to look at it and see what I think about it. I also got an email from Rupert saying, Terry, you love the show and have talked about it on a voicemail to the GGTMC. Really dug your coverage of Night of the Hunter, a favourite film of mine. And one that I hadn't read much about. Was very intrigued to hear about how Mitchum was ultimately left to direct the children in the film. That's fantastic. Anyway, great review. I love the show and look forward to each new episode. Two random questions. Are you a Marx Brothers fan? And if so, what's your favourite film? And what are your favourite 50s science fiction films? Mine are Them and Forbidden Planet. Thanks, Rupert. I am kind of a Marx Brothers fan, but I think Marx Brothers are just so shotgun. It's hard to review a Marx Brothers film in a podcast without giving away the jokes, and it's Marx Brothers films are an experience. I don't watch them very much, but I do like them when I do watch them. But they're going to be a hard one to podcast about. Leaving aside the possibility of still doing so, I'm not going to dismiss it entirely. But I need to do my homework, and I think I've got a couple of reference books that I can do it with if I need to. Favorite 50 science fiction films. Definitely Forbidden Planet. I think that's terrific. It builds a world wonderfully, and I think it stretched the limits of the technology available, and it took the genre seriously. I really like that. The things I've talked about in the podcast I like. Anyway, things like Creation of the Humanoids, I talked about in a very early podcast. That one's really great. Maybe 1962. I think it's 62, so it's not 1950s. I do like Them because I like the way it starts out as a police procedural, but then flows on from that into something weird and wonderful beyond that. What else is there? Tarantula, I like all the giant monster movies. I do like the early Godzilla films. They're pretty good. Let me think. Oh, you got me on the spot here. I like some of the subtle films as well. I like one called Gog, which was done by Ivan Tors, which is about a kind of science city in the desert, which is pretty cool. I kind of steer away from the rubber-suited monster thing because they can be a little samey. I suppose if Creature from the Black Lagoon can be considered science fiction, I like that. You put me on the spot. I'm going to have to get out my new reference book. Sally gave me a copy of the Outlook book of science fiction the other day, an updated version of it as a gift, so I'm going to have to dip into that. But I think one of the nice things is once you know the really big science fiction films, it's good to kind of find the lesser ones, and you'll find some gems in there among the smaller budget things. Let's see, there's Five by Arch Obler. That's a pretty good one too. And The World, the Flesh and the Devil, which I talked about in the podcast, and another excellent one which has a kind of moral point to make, but does it really well, incorporating it into the narrative of a post-apocalyptic movie. So thanks for that, Rupert. Appreciate that one. Let me see what I've got here. I've got a PS from Brian as well. From Rupert, sorry. I've got a PS from Rupert. Forgot to ask, but would love to hear you cover W.C. Fields films. It's a Gift, in particular, which is one of my favourite comedies. We'd also love to hear your thoughts on Don Siegel's film The Verdict with Sidney Greenstreet and Peter Lorre. Just recently saw this on Warner Brothers archive DVD and enjoyed it very much. Going to have to track that one down. I did see a Don Siegel film recently. What was it? Charlie Varrick with Walter Matthau. Nice 70s action film. I think it was one of Siegel's later films. And Matthau is particularly good in it, playing things very much tongue-in-cheek and droll, and with a couple of moments of kind of emotional depth to them too, which made it really interesting. But I'm definitely going to have to put that on my must-find list as well. Here we go. I got one from Big William over at GGTMC. Terry, it's Will here from GGTMC, he says. I just wanted to take this opportunity to thank you for your fine show, for the fine show you put out. Being someone who is truly and deeply passionate about film, whether it's in context of art, education, entertainment or otherwise, I constantly strive to educate myself in it, as I feel it is the most pure form of art, as it's an amalgamation of the oral visual in perfect and sometimes not so perfect harmony. In saying that, my primary purpose with film podcasts has always been to use it as a tool to further my education in film from people who aren't afraid to wade into the proverbial muck of genre cinema and will never thumb their noses at it. People who proudly place their Bruno Mattei films next to their Fellinis on the shelf. You sir do that. I always find myself informed and entertained by your show. Doing a one-man show is a thankless and difficult, yet you do it effortlessly with skill and class. Keep doing what you do and I'll keep listening. We'd love to have you wax poetic on Tough Tits on our show sometime. Ta-ta, Large William. Thanks for that. I will appreciate it, because you guys are kind of a benchmark for me on doing movie podcasts. I do learn a lot from listening to you and Samurai on the show. And I think that's a nice thing. We each learn from each other. We each bring something to the table, and from there learn more and kind of spread the love of cinema as well. He sent me a PS on this one as well. Have you seen Tampico with Eugene Robinson? I recently picked it up and want to know if I should move it up my queue. I sent him a reply to that one where I said I haven't seen Tampico, and I did a bit of a research on it and suggested an alternative for him, which is Moontide from 1942, starring Ida Lupino and Jean Gabin in one of his few American movies. I should really do Moontide on a podcast. I should do Night Tide as well, the Dennis Hopper movie. Maybe I could do a tide-themed podcast at some stage. It's a nice way. We're kind of interacting there and making suggestions for each other and for everyone else as well. So please keep making suggestions. Might not be able to podcast all of them, but I'll definitely try to watch as many of them as I can. And if I can do a brief pricey on them after that, I will. Let me see whether we've got any other emails here. Let's have a look there. Nope, that's pretty much it. So I'm going to close this up. This has been a particularly difficult podcast with the technological difficulties and a little bit of rocky road I'm going along at the moment. So I really appreciate people's feedback on this and the support I've got through Facebook. I did mention that I got the sack on Facebook, and there's been an incredible amount of love and support from people there, some of whom are in the podcasting community, some of whom aren't, and it does mean a lot to me. That kind of support helps more than I can really express. So thanks very much for that. I'm going to finish up the podcast now. I'll put a nice little bit of music of some kind on the end of it. So I'll be back in 3 weeks' time, definitely, doing all this all over again. I'm not sure what I'm going to review, but I'm looking forward to it, and I hope you guys are as well. So that's about it, and I'll catch you in 3 weeks' time. Take care and enjoy your movie watching, and I hope everything is going well in your part of the planet.